We've talked many a time about water on Mars. We know it was once a wetter world with a decent atmosphere, and now it seems possible that just as with Earth, there exists the strong possibility of subterranean oceans, although their ones would be frozen. This comes from new analysis of Martian meteorites, the study of which you can read the details on the Life Science website, actually, suggests that the water on Mars that didn't escape into space froze, forming vast, yet-to-be-discovered reservoirs of ice still hidden below the surface. And here's the kicker, really. That water could be as much as 10% of all the H2O in our own oceans in frozen form. Research out of Nagoya University in Japan, essentially water that contains deuterium, can't escape Mars's gravity, or couldn't in the old days as easily. And by comparing the deuterium to hydrogen ratios in ancient meteorites and then looking at the Martian surface features that suggest surface water once, the scientists did sums, came up with 30 million cubic miles of ice. That's quite a lot. And this is a big discovery. Our guest today on 8 Months to Mars is a scientist who makes big discoveries himself, but interior ones. They're not out there in the cosmos. They're inside our heads. In 2010, he won the Kia World Class Award for Creative Thinking. He's worked for 4 Formula One motor racing teams and top athletes around the world. He's won awards in applied mathematics. He's authored 2 best-selling books. Is the director of the New Zealand Government Goldmine Project to develop cutting-edge electronic and mathematical tools for Olympic medalists. If that's not enough, he's written a screenplay and has recently announced the development of 2 films about Albert Einstein, the first of which is scheduled for release at the end of next year. He's Auckland-born neuroscientist Dr. Kerry Spackman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Nice to meet you.
What an introduction. Effectively, you are a life coach, albeit a very fancy one.
Well, that's an accident that happened, and I don't claim it to be my main bow to my life, but it happened accidentally because I was working with one of the Formula One drivers up in England, and they said, oh, you're the brain guy. This guy's got a few problems. Can you help? And I had no interest in it up until that point of view. I was always involved in mathematics and optimization and things. And I said, well, I don't know much about it, but, you know, I'll do my homework and see if I can help you. And as fate happened, I came up with some ideas for him, and he said, wow, they really worked. And a year later, I was driving through London, and I got a phone call from this Formula One driver, and he said, just want to tell you that I've used the techniques you've put together for a whole year now. Because when I first said it to him, he said, oh, that'll never work. That'll never work. I've got every self-help book under the sun. They don't work. And I said, well, we'll just try this. And he said, you know, you've got to turn this into a book. So I said, well, I'll give it a go. So that's how that happened. But it hasn't been my prime thrust in life, but it's been certainly an interesting journey for me, for sure. And, you know, the book went to number one, so it's been very good.
You've worked with a whole lot of people, Hollywood stars. In fact, when Katie Melua was singing, you said you haven't worked with her, but you met her once.
Yes, that was an accident. I was up in London at a charity event, and they were auctioning off quite a few things, and I was just out in a corner by myself, just sitting there. And there was this young lady in the corner all by herself, just quietly sitting there. And she just kind of was very alone. So I just sort of went up to her and said, are you okay? She said, yeah, I'm okay. I'm just getting ready. And I said, well, what are you getting ready for? She said, oh, well, I'm about to sing. And I said, oh, are you a singer? She said, well, kind of. And I said, you know, who are you? And she said, Katie Melua. And I said, oh, well, you are a good singer. And we ended up talking for about 45 minutes. About the meaning of life, actually, because she had got through that very interesting part of her career where she'd quickly risen to the top, and then just said, it's all nonsense, and what's it all about? And we had a good 45-minute chat, and then she went and performed a new song she'd just written, and fabulous lady.
I read that she went through a dark time after early fame. That is interesting. Well, we won't talk too much about Katie, although that would be a conversation in itself. But you've worked with Lewis Hamilton, with the McLaren Racing team. You worked with 4 Formula One racing teams. How did you get involved with Formula One?
Well, again, that was a bit of an accident. I had developed some electronics here in New Zealand, which I went around the world selling to various motor companies, Rolls-Royce, Toyota, Nissan. And one of the companies I went to was Ford Motor Company, to sell this electronics. And the day I turned up was the day Jackie Stewart turned up, and he was here to test some cars. And I was under a car mounting all these electronics, and Jackie came over and said, you know, what have you got here? And I started to explain. He said, ah, telemetry. I've seen all that in Formula One. And he walked off. And I thought, crikey, this is my last dollar. I spent all my money trying to get here to make this equipment, and he's kind of written it off. And anyways, fate would have it, he drove the car around the racetrack and came back, and he said, oh, you up on the stage there, you've got something in this car. What did you see? So I showed him, and of course there was the president and the vice president of Ford and all the engineers there, and I showed him, and he goes, well, that is interesting. I haven't seen that before. And then he said, I made one mistake out there. Can you find the mistake? Because it was an experimental test car that he was driving for Ford, and this was something that's going to come out in about 5 years' time. And I had a hunch, and I just zoomed up on one corner, and I go, oh, yeah, actually, on lap three, you did this instead of that. And Jackie said, no, that is extraordinary. And he turned to the vice president of Ford and said, whatever this thing is, you've got to buy it. And then so Jackie and I got together as a partnership, because I sold this equipment to Ford, and they said, you know, as part of the deal, you have to use it for us. And so the idea was to measure these experimental cars. And while I was looking at the experimental cars, I noticed the test drivers were all different. And I thought, well, if they're all different, they can't be all doing the optimal result. Mm. So typical Kiwi fashion, not knowing anything about it, I rang up the vice president of Ford and said, hi, I'm Kerry, you don't know who I am, but I don't think your test drivers are very good. And he had a laugh down the phone. He said, well, let's have a meeting with them and you can tell them they're no good. To cut a long story short, we ended up testing them and found that there were, in fact, many holes in their driving. And so Ford said, could you develop a program? And that's where I got into neuroscience. I said, I don't know anything about it, but I'll go and see what they do at the RAF. I'll see what they do for the Top Gun pilots and how they train them and see if I can come up with some ideas. And that's when I really got to know Jackie. And then, of course, he set up a Formula One team, and I followed him in there. So kind of a convoluted, I just kept following the leads.
Yeah, that's a great story. Just to amplify that a bit more, so what is it that you do for the drivers in the cars, or you've ended up doing for them?
Well, there's been a couple of things. So initially what I started doing with the Formula One cars was the optimization of the aerodynamics and the suspension. So it was all car-based.
Yeah.
But also part of that, we looked at how the drivers drove the car and tried to find what I would call optimal solutions. And it's very difficult in a Formula One car because they're dominated by aerodynamics. They're dominated by huge downforce. And so the behavior of the car changes dramatically as the speed changes. And finding an optimal solution is very different to us driving a normal car.
Yeah.
So I got involved in helping the drivers find the best solutions and work out how to do that. And then got very involved with what they need to do for elite performance. And a Formula One car is so difficult and so different that the human brain really does struggle to keep up at those sorts of speeds and those sorts of forces.
Yeah.
And then from there got involved in helping develop a simulator that McLaren had. Again, that was, again, by chance. They said, well, you know, you're the brain guy. Can you help with the simulator? And so I helped a fantastic simulator built by British Aerospace and McLaren, just really outstanding. But the drivers felt it didn't feel real. It still felt like they were in a simulator. I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of kit. I mean, even the moss on the signs on the side of the track was modelled, every bump. It's just extraordinary. So what I tried to do is add in tricks to fool the brain to make it feel more real. So again, just following the leads.
Okay. So what you do is you try and optimise the brain to handle more efficiently all the information that comes in.
That was what I was doing with the Formula One drivers and finding the best solution, yeah. And they're the human brain is overloaded. You know, we only absorb a very small percentage of all the information coming to us, and the key is how do you make best use of that information under high stress, being overloaded.
Okay, and you teach a version of that in your bestseller, The Winner's Bible. In other words, you translated that kind of brain processing that the Formula One drivers were using into our own brain processing?
Not quite. So there was that aspect, which is the technical aspect of driving. There's also the aspect of elite performance. And what this Formula One driver said is, you know, most books are about motivation. Rah, 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 let's motivate you.
Yeah.
He said, I'm motivated. There's no question about that. You know, I didn't get to be a Formula One champion without being motivated.
Yeah.
But I'm struggling. And so for me, the question was, what are the tools we can use to be more higher performance as opposed to rules. And to put it into perspective, you know, you can imagine a book, Seven Ways to Beat Roger Federer at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. You know, rule number one, hit the ball where Federer can't get it.
Yeah.
You know, well, that's going to win every time. Easy rule, hit the ball where he can't get it. The question is, how do I do that?
Mm.
So that rule, so many self-help books have rules. For me, it's about tools. What tools can we use to overcome a problem, to find out more about yourself, to be tailored to you? Because, you know, you're a different person to me.
Mm.
Your genetics are different to me. Your physiology is different. Your history is different. Your psychology is different. So we need to be able to optimize you. And that's a very specific person. So a general purpose rule is not going to work.
Some of it involves reprogramming, doesn't it? I mean, everyone's performance is suboptimal.
Mm-hmm.
You would probably agree.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the performance impairment, isn't it, of bad habits and faulty genes, not just brain malfunction. I mean, we act contrary often, don't we, in life to our own analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So you are working with what inside the brain then? It's not just the logical circuits of the brain.
Yes, so that's really important. I think a lot of people think the brain is like this one big computer, a single CPU.
Yeah.
But actually it's made up of lots of different modules. And these modules, some are emotional, some are more logical, some are dedicated to vision processing, some are to hearing. And what's really interesting is that the emotional circuits are primitive, but they have an enormous power. So, for example, just to put it into perspective, if you have an event in your life, if it's highly emotional, the emotional circuits say, oh, this is really important. We're going to file that event in a slightly different part of your brain, and we're going to give extra effort, without you knowing about it, to storing this. So, for example, this thing's called like light bulb moments, where you may have been driving your car somewhere and you heard the news that Princess Diana had been killed.
Mm.
That, or the World Trade Center had gone down and terrorists had stuck. So those are highly emotional, highly significant events, and they get seared on your soul because the emotional circuits, they do it for a good reason. If something's emotional, it's either going to hurt you or it's good for you, so we need to remember that. Mm. The problem is, of course, that when we're young, we have a lot of experiences which may or may not be valid logically, but we may be in an emotional state at the time. And to give you an example, imagine a little girl, you know, 6 years old in the playground, and over in the distance she sees all the cool kids and she wants to join them. So she's emotionally vulnerable for that moment and she calls out, hey, can I come and join you? If one of the cool kids says, nah, you're too ugly, at that moment, that throwaway line, which may have no basis in reality, is seared in her soul. And she may go through life thinking she's ugly, regardless. And I've actually met with a supermodel who was on the front cover of Vogue, I think it was, and she thought she was ugly. Logically, she knew she was pretty. Logically, she could look in the mirror and say, I must be pretty, I'm on the front cover of Vogue, and people pay me hundreds of thousands of dollars. But I don't feel pretty because when she was younger, she suddenly grew very tall. She was about 10 or 11, and she was nicknamed the giraffe because she suddenly grew. And that stuck with her. And no amount of just telling her you're beautiful is going to help.
Yeah.
You actually have to undo that emotional connection. And that's a non-trivial task, and you have to understand how that works.
Yeah, okay. And we've all had those moments. Of course, that kind of emotional bad wiring can also impel as well as impede us, can't it? It can make us try and achieve.
Yes, certainly. I mean, the old saying, don't quite know how it goes, but, you know, show me a successful man and I'll show you a man with some serious defect going on, you know, because you're overcompensating or whatever.
Yeah.
And there's a certain amount of truth to that. You know, a lot of very successful people are overcoming things, and that's great. The question is always balance.
Of course. All right. So if I were given the constraints of, you know, our time together, and we want to hear your favourite music and talk a little bit about Mars, if I was at a dinner party and I buttonholed you and said, can you tell me in 25 words or less, you know, in the Winner's Bible, how do you reprogram people to make them forget those awful playground traumas? What would you say?
I would say there is no 25-word answer. In fact, I've had a few people ring me up and say, can you give me the short answer? And I say, well, there isn't a short answer, you know, there just isn't. And if there was a short answer, you know, we'd all be doing it. It is a complicated, not a complicated, it is a process that you need to go through of identifying, working out the best solution. You know, a surgeon doesn't just get his knife and dig into you and chop you apart. He has to plan carefully. He has to work out where the incisions need to be made. And so that's part of what the book is about, the Winner's Bible, is, you know, how do you go through that process? So I don't think, unfortunately, there's no shortcuts. You know,
no.
I had an old girlfriend who was a world duathlon champion, and her favourite saying is, there are no shortcuts.
There are no shortcuts.
I've never seen one.
We're sold all the shortcuts, aren't we? We're sold, as you say, the self-help books. We're sold the imaging techniques, you know, the vision statements. None of them will erase that memory of the playground from that week on.
Not that simply, but the good news is, of course, and since the book has been out, I've had literally thousands of people have written in and said, you know, that worked for me. I even had a guy who was living in Australia who flew to New Zealand to commit suicide. He flew to Queenstown because he thought he had heard it was a beautiful place, and he bought a one-way ticket to Queenstown to die. No luggage, nothing. And he came, and as he was walking out of the airport, he saw my little book. And he thought, a winner's Bible. I don't know what a winner is. I'm a loser.
Mm.
And he bought the book and flicked through it. And, of course, it worked for him because he called me, well, emailed me a year later and said, you know, I'm back in Australia. I've just married. I can't remember. Just married or just got engaged. And life is great. So it's worked for him. Now, of course, it doesn't work for everybody. I don't claim my book's a panacea. But it's nice when you get those sorts of stories.
Oh, yes.
Lives turned around.
Did it work for you, or you didn't need it to work for you?
No, it didn't. No. I use it myself because, you know, like everybody else, I have a whole pile of baggage that I come to, both physiologically and history and everything like that. And so, you know, you've read out a few of my successes, and I think without some of those tools, I wouldn't be able to do those things.
It must involve changing the little mantras, daily mantras in your life, though.
Yes, you have to change, and, you know, as you can see, my career has been quite varied, and you have to follow those things that you do, and that requires change. You know, that's part of the whole process of the Winner's Bible. You make up your own little personal thing, which changes day to day. So as I grow and change, and as you grow and change, what we need today should be different to what we needed yesterday. Otherwise, we haven't changed.
Dr. Kerry Spackman, going to Mars. Well, I haven't even asked you that yet, but you're living back in New Zealand now.
And loving it.
Is that to get the Einstein project off the ground?
Yes, it is, partly. So partly I'm doing some work with high-performance sport with our elite athletes, so that's nice, and I'm enjoying that. That's a really good project, and that's about electronics and hardware, so that's not the motivation. It's just about giving them secret techniques inside their equipment, which so our top rowers, cyclists, and people have electronics that other countries don't have. So I try to bring some sort of Formula One technology back. Really enjoying that project. But what's really good about New Zealand is I live out in Kumeu in what I call my little spack shack. And it's tucked away, you know, sort of 7 or 8 acres, facing the sun. I can look over the Auckland City, peace and quiet, sheep all around. And that is a great place to be creative. I find when I'm up in places like England or London, it's so busy. It's hard to actually be creative. You know, you need that mental space. So I love it being back here. Of course, I've got family back here as well, so that's important.
Never trust a thought you haven't had outdoors.
It's a good one.
All right, now, would you be a goer? I'll ask you about the Einstein films because that's fascinating, but would you be a goer for Mars or not?
I wouldn't be, no.
And sorry to hear that.
No, I just love this planet that we're on. It's just such a wonderful planet, and you know, I can't imagine, you know, just the culture and the history and everything we build up and the people, to leave that, take a very special person, and I'm not that special.
Okay, now you've made a good choice of planet. Okay, but if you had to go away somewhere for a long period of time, who would you take with you? What companions would you like to be marooned somewhere with?
Well, I'd have a variety, I think. Obviously, because I'm so deeply involved in the Einstein project, I'd take Einstein along with me because he was a truly extraordinary individual. I mean, most people know him as a scientist, but, you know, he was probably the world's first long-haired hippie, anti-establishment, peace-loving person, took on J. Edgar Hoover, helped motivate the black civil rights movement in America, got people like Martin Luther King going, stood up for feminist rights, took on Hitler, was elected president of Israel without even standing. I mean, the list just goes on. And every piece of electronics we have today, to some extent, can be traced back to him. So a really, and he spoke many languages fluently, could discourse on philosophy, just an interesting fellow. And of course, general relativity is just such a difficult task. 8 months, I'm sure he'd give me a few pointers on that, so that'd be kind of fun. So that's one type of person. I'd probably take someone completely different, maybe Clive James, just because he's probably an older fellow. I don't know if he's even alive still, but he is alive. But, you know, what an interesting character.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. So Einstein and Clive James.
Yeah, interesting characters.
You'd have great conversations.
Back to Einstein, the topic of shortly. Dr. Kerry Speckman, 8 months to Mars. Your first song choice from John Lennon.
Yes. I love that song, Imagine. It's very simple, but I love the feeling of it, which is, you know, above us, only sky. You know, there's no heaven or hell. Below us, no hell. We're all here on this little planet, which I guess is quite topical about going to Mars, that we're all here, we have one life, we have one planet, and we should all get on with it and live together in peace. And crikey, you know, if that was a mantra, we're talking about mantras that everybody in the world took on and actually lived by today, the world would be just a completely different place. It's just such a simple song.
They don't, though, of course.
No, they don't. But it's a lovely, lovely thought to have and to try and aspire to.
More of them need to read your book. Dr. Kerry Speckman, Going to Mars, and it's 16 to 2, John Lennon. Imagine, John Lennon, Kerry Speckman, 8 months to Mars. So there is no hell below us. and there's no heaven either. You agree with that, as it says in the song? What is the universe, by design or accident?
Well, that's a very interesting question. That is it design or accident? And I think it's neither, and I'll explain why. So if you imagine a little piece of logic here, if Kerry is older than Bill, and Bill is older than Jude, logically, Kerry must be older than Jude. There's no other way around that. So we'd all agree that just that simple premise, logic must be absolutely true. The question is, did anyone invent logic, or did it have to be true? Maybe there are certain things that exist all by themselves. Could it be any other way? If A is bigger than B and B is bigger than C, could it be any other way than A has to be bigger than C? There's no other option. Now, we take a slight extension on there, and we take the theorem of Pythagoras, C squared equals A squared plus B squared for a triangle and a plane. Now, that has to be true. Not even God could change that if we're talking about a plane. It's like logic. It must be true.
God couldn't change his own logic, yeah?
Well, it's just not possible whether there was a God or not a God. It couldn't be anything other because it would just be nonsense. You couldn't have A being bigger than B and B being bigger than C and A being smaller than C. So we come to the conclusion that mathematics and logic just necessarily are true. Now, what's really interesting is that the universe seems to be constructed unreasonably out of mathematical logic. And that's really quite extraordinary. So you can follow the mathematics, which is, for example, what Einstein did. He said, I'm not going to do experiments. I'm just going to sit here in my little room with my pencil and paper, and I'm just going to follow the maths. And he came up with all these incredible predictions that led to things like black holes, which just sounded bizarre, things like the universe exploding in a big bang, very precise predictions. And it's not like Nostradamus, where you say, you know, you might meet a guy who's a kindly gentleman on Wednesday. Well, that, anything can fit that. It's a very, very, very specific prediction. And mathematics makes these predictions millions of times over, and it gets them right. And so mathematics seems to be self-contained. It seems to describe the universe, and it doesn't seem to need anything to underpin it. So is it accident? No. Is it design? No. It just is.
It just is. Your mate Kerry could end up being younger than Jude. Of course, the faster he travelled through space, the slower through time, according to your mate Einstein.
That's correct. Well, you don't get younger, you just don't get older.
Yes. All right, so after the Big Bang, we've heard a lot about the surges after the Big Bang recently, and the fact that they suggest multiverses, that those enormous split-second-later bursts of energy that to scientists suggest, you know, multiverses and perhaps even an infinity of universes, you know, just rocketing out, although not physically, or perhaps physically, into the void. What does this mean to you, the whole multiverse concept? Could the rules be different between one universe and another?
I think that's the implication. So I think, you know, if you go back a few thousand years ago, the Earth was at the centre of the universe, and the suns and the planets went around the Earth. Then, of course, we had the Copernican Revolution, and we were just a planet orbiting the sun. Then we find that the sun is just a typical star in a galaxy. And then, lo and behold, we find we're just one galaxy out of tens of billions of galaxies. I mean, tens of billions. So our point at the centre of the universe has just got less and less and less. And now what we're finding, and this seems to be the case from these gravitational wave polarizations, that our universe is just one of many universes. And, of course, the question has always been, why is our universe so nicely tuned for us? Because if it was slightly different, it wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
And the multiverse, of course, says, well, you can have millions of universes popping out all the time, endlessly, and they all have different physics, and some of them will just give rise to the right conditions. It's inevitable that it will. So I guess in that point, we're an accident.
Some of those sort of quantum dreamers have postulated universes that are very like our own, where Kerry Spackman didn't happen to run into Katie Melua up in London that time, but in other respects, his life was pretty much the same, but small tweaks changed it. Do you subscribe to those kinds of fantasy, a lot like our own universe theories or not?
It's possible, but I guess all I do know is what happens here and now.
Yeah.
So all I can talk about is my universe, the universe that we live in. And what's interesting is that not every belief that you can have actually fits with the universe we have. You know, the belief that the Earth is flat, that just doesn't work anymore. So what I'm interested in is what beliefs match our reality and our life, because I can't do anything about a different universe, and to some extent it's irrelevant.
All right, so it just is. You would apply that same phrase to what was there before the Big Bang. It just was.
I think there's just this endless sea of space-time, whatever, that gets popped out from these quantum fluctuations, and they just keep popping out and giving rise to an entire universe. It's just quite extraordinary, but the physics predicts it, and of course physics predicts things that you just think, well, that's just ridiculous. Like an electron being in two places at once,
yeah,
or being able to go from one place to another without being in the place in the middle. But of course, that's how every computer works. Every computer relies on an electron going from one place to another without ever being in the middle. I mean, that to a human is mind-boggling. It's what the physics says. That's how semiconductors work. And that can only work that way. So these bizarre things are actually what happened.
We're only just beginning to know, aren't we?
We're only just beginning. And I think the interesting thing is that the great unknown, and that's one of the things I talk about in my other book, The Ant and the Ferrari, is the great unknown. You know, there's things we know, there's things we don't know, and there's things we don't even know we don't even know. And I call that the great unknown.
You and Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah, me and Donald Rumsfeld. Well, a great company to be in. But I think, mankind has a habit of making up theories to fit the facts, when in fact no theory would be a better theory. We just get uncomfortable. You know, you think about lightning. We didn't know how it worked. And so we thought, gosh, we need to invent some idea. So we come up with Zeus throwing thunderbolts from heaven. Of course, it's nonsense. And I think one of the interesting things is if we can actually say we just don't know.
I don't want to shortchange you about this tremendous Albert Einstein project, Dr. Kerry Spackman, 8 months to Mars. Now, what is it? Is it two films?
Yes, there's two films. One set in 1905 to 1922, which is the younger Einstein. It's not a documentary. It's a fantastic story, very character-driven, kind of along the lines of, I would describe it as a cross between Shawshank Redemption and Dr. Zhivago. So it's an epic, big, lush story with World War One, the whole thing going on there. But you have this these characters that are colliding in the first story. That's Einstein's compass. And then we pick up the story again much later, the very later years of Einstein in 1950s, just before he died, and that one's called Papa Einstein. So two, because for me there are two quite distinct Einsteins. The young Einstein and the old Einstein are quite different people, which is great because he developed and he grew. You know, again, if he was the same person, then he hadn't grown. And but they're two quite self-contained stories, although there is a link between them, as you can imagine.
The compass was given to him when he was sick as a boy, wasn't it?
Yes, he was, and this is where the title comes from. There's a little boy in 1889, 5 years old in bed, and he was bored, and his father gave him a compass and a magnet to play with. And his father just watched the little boy swinging the magnet around and the compass going and thought nothing more of it. Just like I've played with the compass and you've probably played with the compass. And that event changed everybody alive today. Every cell phone, every computer, every DVD, everything came from that one experience. And so the compass metaphor has a couple of angles to it. One is the father had no idea that his actions had this long-term event effect. So I may say something to somebody and I may never know the impact. Mm. Just like that man who read the book and didn't commit suicide, if he hadn't emailed me, I would have never have known. Mm. So the things we do each day have an impact that flows on forever. The other aspect of the compass, of course, is that Einstein saw something hidden. He saw something magic. He said, I don't understand how the needle moves without something touching it, because normally things move only when they're touched. So he saw a mystery that most of us miss. And one of the things I want to bring out in the movie is this sense of mystery and awe.
How far, I want to bring up Shostakovich shortly, actually, because you're such a good talker, we haven't had time for much music. How far along are the movies? What stage are you at?
Very early stages, but we've got lots of momentum, and trying to talk to the very best A-list directors and script writers to take my early script to a professional level, so we're aiming for the very best, you know, like the top sort of $40 million budget.
I'll tell you what, everyone would go and see movies about Einstein.
Yeah.
Whether they had much of a particular interest, however sexy they thought it was at the start, and I'm sure you could sell it in a pretty alluring manner, they'd go and see them.
Everyone who's read the script said, I've heard of him, I knew he was a scientist, I had no idea of the story. Everybody. And they all Google it and go, that can't be true. I mean, some of the characters, we've got the original Dr. Evil. I'm sure the guy that Mike Myers based Dr. Evil on is one of the characters in this movie. I mean, he looks like Dr. Evil, he acts like Dr. Evil, and these are real characters that collide against Einstein, and you go, it's a fantastic story.
So you're thinking Einstein's compass for the end of next year, even?
That's my ambitious target. Hopefully, I'm really pushing towards that.
Well, you're a man with top connections all around the world, so that must assist. I mean, doors open. People will certainly talk to you, won't they?
That's been the big benefit I've had. I think if I was just a person without these connections, it would be near impossible. But I've been very lucky to have, you know, people like the Jackie Stewarts of this world, you know, who are connected to people that can help.
All right. Let's just bring up Shostakovich. You're particularly fond of this piece of music. Why?
It's a very haunting piece of music, and it has kind of a soaring part where it rises above the everyday. It has a kind of a sad part, and in fact I'm going to, in the second movie, just as Einstein dies, because he was a great violinist himself, he played the violin, you'll see it's quite haunting, then it ends very quietly. So I think it's quite appropriate.
Okay. You wouldn't be on Mars looking back towards Earth, but nevertheless you are out at Kumiu, and I wonder, do you actually quite like it away from the madding crowd? There are things about civilization you don't miss.
Yes, New Zealand drivers, they're the worst in the world. People in the outside lane, hogging the outside lane, going nowhere. The road markings here defy any logic. There's a piece of road out in Kumiu where there's two lanes, and the right-hand lane drives straight into the oncoming traffic. It's just bizarre. There's no markings, nothing. It just goes straight across the middle of the road. And you go, how's that ever going to work?
There you go. A neuroscientist has picked that up. Not just you and me. Dr. Kerry Speckman, thank you. Good luck with the films. We'll follow their progress with immense interest.
Thanks very much.
And very nice to have you as a guest today.
Thank you very much.
And until 2 o'clock, we are hearing from Dmitri Shostakovich, and this is Romance.